Good evening and welcome to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, here on Countercurrents. A couple of weeks ago, I spoke a little bit about the emerging radical trends in U.S. politics, and I want to follow up on that theme a little bit this evening. Tonight, I want to talk a little bit about what some of the trends show is likely to be the future of U.S. politics and some developments we can likely expect in the future. When I analyze these kinds of questions, one thing that I always try to keep in mind is the necessity of having a realistic and practical outlook. I'm a big believer in realism, and much of what I do is based on things like trends, research, historical precedents, trying to observe general patterns over time. I am trained as a historian and as a social scientist, and I try to approach these things in a non-ideological and value-free way, in a way that really just takes a look at the facts and goes from there. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't have any general principles that I also start with, but I don't try to make the facts fit the philosophy or the ideology. I tend to look at it from the other angle, that the facts, I mean, the ideology or the philosophy need to be made to fit the facts. As I said, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about the emerging radicalism in American society, and I want to talk a little bit about some predictable trends that we will likely see in the future. And we can start with the discussion of the current election that's coming up in another month or so. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I don't support either of the candidates or either of the major parties. I personally haven't voted for anyone in, I think, about 20 years now. Prior to that, I used to vote for Democrats occasionally. I don't think I've ever voted for a Republican. So when I discuss the some of the implications of the election that's coming up, I'm not talking about it from the perspective of any kind of partisan, nor did I watch the recent debate between Romney and Obama. I'm not really one for spending my time watching two sock puppets of the ruling class give their pre-rehearsed speeches. So that's not really what I'm looking at when I talk about this kind of issue. Rather, I want to talk about some of the wider implications of and some of the trends that we see emerging in American politics that are in some way symbolized by some of the goings on in this particular election. I think we're entering a phase now where we're seeing something of a transition in American politics. In spite of the fact that some pundits have been saying that Romney did well at his recent debate with Obama and now he's moving ahead in the polls, in spite of that, all of the data that I have seen over the last couple of days concerning what's actually going on in the Electoral College, meaning how many states is Obama likely to win versus Romney and how many electoral votes each candidate is likely to win. From the data that I've seen, Obama is still way ahead in the Electoral College. I think this morning I looked at the Real Clear Politics website, which has something of a Republican leaning editorial position, and they right now are giving 230 electoral votes to Obama, and there's still about 160, I think it was 106 toss-up votes still available. So Obama is still way ahead in the Electoral College and is still likely to be the winner of the upcoming election. But in the past, a lot of conventional political scientists in the United States would tend to look at presidential elections and regard them as something of a referendum on an incumbency, meaning whether or not an incumbent gets reelected is really dependent on how the voters, the electorate, the public at large views that particular incumbent. It's not so much a matter of who the challenger is; it's more of a referendum on the incumbent. For example, some people say that the one of the reasons that Bill Clinton was elected in 1992 was primarily because so many people were dissatisfied with George H.W. Bush. Another type of yardstick that political scientists have used in the past to try to gauge how an election is going is to characterize an election as a type of referendum on the economy, meaning that if the economy is perceived as doing well, then the incumbent has the advantage. If the economy is perceived as not doing well, then the challenger has the advantage. Also, some political scientists will use finance as a means of trying to predict the outcome of an election. What I mean by that is that statistical data shows that the candidate for a public office that has the most money, not necessarily the most money personally, but the most money in terms of their campaign organization and resources available for campaign advertising and so forth, the candidate whose organization has the most money tends to win 90% of the time. So these are some of the yardsticks, if you will, or gauges that political scientists will use to try to predict the outcome of elections, the state of the economy, the public perception of the incumbent, and which candidate has the most money. But now I think that something is happening and has started to happen in the last few years. And I think it's something that a lot of mainstream commentators are missing. It's a transition that's taking place, and it's a transition where we're moving more to an electoral system where people tend to vote more along blocks or along tribal lines, if you will, with the term tribe being very broadly and loosely defined. But more and more, I think the evidence shows that people tend to vote and are increasingly voting with their own cultural and socioeconomic reference groups, rather than what they think of the incumbent per se, or what they think of the current state of the economy per se. There's a lot of evidence for that. And of course, that's the way electoral politics works in many other countries. For instance, if we look at the results of an election somewhere like Iraq, we can predict with almost absolute certainty that Kurds will vote for Kurds, Shiites will vote for Shiites, Sunni will vote for Sunni, and so forth. And that hasn't necessarily been the case quite as much in American politics as it is in some other places. But I think more and more we're moving to a system like that, where voting patterns are predictable along demographic lines, regardless of the state of the economy, regardless of which candidate has the most money, regardless of what people think of the incumbent. For instance, Barack Obama's approval ratings are not particularly high, and he's not widely perceived of as being that great of a president. But I still think that a wide assortment of demographic groups of voting blocks, so to speak, will vote for him anyway, irrespective of their perception of his performance. Now, in order to explain why that is, I think we can go back and look at some observations that other commentators have made in the past. For instance, back in 1997, back in 1997, Peter Bremelow, who is probably most well known for being the editor of the VDare.com website, he used to be an editor at National Review. I think he was a financial writer for Forbes at one point. I met him in person once a few years ago at a conference. But Peter Bremelow wrote an article called "Electing a New People" back in 1997, and the phrase "electing a new people" is taken from the East German, the former East German writer Bertolt Brecht. But what it means is that Peter Bremelow was arguing in this that what the oligarchy who rules this country is doing is essentially electing a new people, meaning they are through a variety of policies engineering a demographic transformation in American society that will put a particular oligarchy in power on an indefinite basis. They're essentially creating a permanent constituency for themselves through demographic change. And of course, it's not just in the United States that's going on. A few years ago, there was some report given, I think from a former speechwriter for Tony Blair, who said that in England, there had been a similar plan developed by the Labour Party, whereby they would create a permanent constituency for themselves through radical demographic change in the society. And Peter Brimelow pointed this out in way back in 1997 in this article, Electing a New People. Now, in the year 2002, there was a book published by a couple of writers who were at the time associated with the New Republic, which is sort of, I suppose you could say, it's a neocon-friendly, left-liberal type of magazine. Certainly not a magazine associated with the alternative right, and really not an anti-establishment magazine in any sense. But this particular book was titled The Emerging Democratic Majority. And what they argued in this, although albeit from a different philosophical perspective, but what these authors argued was basically the same thing that Peter Brimelow had argued a few years earlier, and that is that demographic and cultural change and generational change is taking place in American society in such a way as to give the left a solid electoral majority. And a few years ago, I personally did a study of voting patterns in U.S. elections. The article that I wrote where I outlined the results of some of that is actually available at attackthesystem.com. If you Google, is something really wrong with Kansas? Is something really wrong with Kansas is the name of it. That title is a play on a book that was written by Thomas Frank, a leftist writer, who wrote a book called What's Wrong with Kansas some years ago. But I actually wrote an article where I was debunking some of the arguments that Frank made in his book, where he was trying to argue that the reason Republicans were able to win election was that you have people who are voting, people who are from the working class and so forth, who are voting with the right against their own supposed economic interest over social issues. I did some research and crunched some numbers, and the research that I did showed that that's not necessarily the case, that there's actually not a lot of that going on, like some from the left have claimed. But you can Google that article, Is Something Really Wrong with Kansas, and it's on my website, attackthesystem.com. But as I said, more and more now what we're starting to see is U.S. voters voting along tribal or lines, or along the lines of their own reference groups, irrespective of a candidate's incumbency or irrespective of the state of the economy and so forth. Now, all of this, I think, is a manifestation of a lot of different changes. I think, obviously, one is demographic change, the increased ethnic and racial diversification of the United States. Parallel to that is cultural change, the rise of movements like feminism, the gay rights movement, the ecology movement, and so forth, all of which are oriented towards the left and have the effect of strengthening the left politically. Some of it is generational change. You now have entire generations that have grown up in the era after the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, and really have never known anything different. You know, the so-called MTV generation and all that. I think another thing that's fueling some of this is economic change. As I've mentioned on past broadcasts, the gap between the social classes tends to be growing. And that, I think, has the effect of pushing the vote towards the left in many ways, because people tend to start looking to government to get them out of trouble economically when they're experiencing economic difficulties. Also, there's the issue of partisan cycles. If you look at the history of which political party has been dominant over during specific periods of time throughout American history, we see that the Democrats were dominant from roughly 1932, when Franklin Roosevelt was elected, up through the late 60s when Richard Nixon was elected president. And then the Republicans were dominant throughout the Nixon years and through the Reagan and George H.W. Bush years on into George W. Bush, and with only a couple of administrations being Democratic administrations during that time. And it looks like now the pendulum is starting to swing back the other way towards the Democratic Party and by extension towards the center left and so forth. Now, as far as what's driving a lot of American politics at present, I think we can look at some other past presidents. For instance, any kind of movement that becomes successful politically tends to have some unifying thread that holds that movement together. There can be all kinds of conflicting beliefs and ideas and so forth within that particular movement. But there's ultimately got to be some glue that holds a movement together. For instance, if we look at the classical socialist movement from the 19th and early 20th century, or we can more broadly describe it as the labor movement, we see that there were all different kinds of belief systems that existed in that movement. You had utopians and Christian socialists and Marxists and social democrats and syndicalists and trade unionists and lots of other things. But the core value, the core idea that was the unifying thread within all of these movements was what they used to call the social question or the labor question or the condition of the working class. In other words, proletarianism. All of these movements were about advancing the conditions of the working class in early industrial societies of the kind we had back in those days, and where the condition of the working class was often deplorable. These were all movements that were trying to address that issue in different ways, even though they may have been widely diverse in terms of what their proposed solutions were, in terms of what their philosophical foundations were. Now, if we look at the American conservative movement that emerged in the post-war era, in the period of roughly the 1950s, up through the time that the neoconservatives came to fully dominate it at the end of the Cold War, we really see that in post-war American conservatism, there were a lot of different trends. That you had some people who were, free market libertarians. You had people who were more traditionalists. You had some that were thrown and altar types. You had some that were left-wing anti-communists. But the Cold War and anti-communism was really the glue that held the post-war conservative movement together. And as a lot of commentators, particularly paleoconservatives, have pointed out since then, when the Cold War ended, the American conservative movement really fell apart in many ways. You had it split off into a lot of different factions, the neocons, the paleocons, the libertarians, the religious right, and so on. And the neocons ended up getting control of it. I remember there was a book that was written back in the late 80s, early 90s by R. Emmett Terrell, who was the editor of the American Spectator magazine. And he was talking about how the conservative movement had had cracked up. It had split off into all these different factions because of the loss of this unifying force. And that was the perceived need to fight the Cold War and fight communism and things like that. Now, when it comes to the American left, there is a single unifying thread to that as well that I think can be identified. And I see that I'm running out of time here for this particular segment. So when I come back in just a moment, I will talk a little bit more about that. Back in a few.
Break through the carapace of the mass media with all of its multiple gorgon-like heads and its hydra-like amphitheatre. Only when you can break through that using the internet have you a chance to embolden the necessary vanguard of our own population. Getting a few people elected will not suffice, in my view, at the present time. What will suffice is a countercurrent and a countercultural revolution which reverses the process of the 1960s. There's a boredom that has settled upon our people. Sense it. There's a spiritual torpor out there, and the most exciting ideas, the most threatening ideas, the most psychopathological ideas, the ideas which are beyond all other ideas, are the ideas which are in this room. They are the most dangerous ideas, and therefore they have a subtle attraction to radical and dissident minds.
Okay, this is Keith Preston. I'm back here at Attack the System on Countercurrents. I mentioned at the end of the last segment that in any kind of movement, there is a single unifying thread that holds that movement together. In classical socialism, it was proletarianism and the need to improve the conditions of the working class. In the post-war U.S. conservative movement, it was anti-communism and the Cold War. And I think that the modern American left, I think a similar analysis can also be applied to the left in the other Western nations as well, but or certainly the Western European nations. I think that the American left in its present form also has a single unifying thread. If we look at the American left, just the mainstream left, although a similar analysis can be applied, I think, to the radical left, you know, the left is really outside the Democratic Party. But if we look at just the center left, the mainstream liberal left that's oriented towards the Democratic Party itself, we see a lot of diversity. For instance, we see a diversity of class, of race and ethnicity, of religion, of culture, a lot of different things. One thing, as far as class, within the Democratic Party, we certainly see plenty of big business, big capital, big banking interests. We see a lot of middle class sectors. For instance, we see that upper middle class professional people, academics, bureaucrats, and so forth tend to lean towards the Democratic Party. We also see that a lot of blue collar workers, the working class, tends to lean towards the Democratic Party. And we see a lot of the poor, people who are likely to be on public assistance and things like that, also lean towards the Democratic Party. So there's a great deal of what we might call class diversity within the Democratic Party itself. We also see a great deal of ethnic and racial diversity. For instance, right now I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry for the Democratic Party, and it's got this one section that lists the voter base for the Democratic Party, and it says Black Americans, Hispanic and Latino Americans, Native Americans, Jewish Americans, Asian Americans, Arab and Muslim Americans. Obviously, there's a great deal of racial and ethnic diversity there. It's also true that white ethnics tend to lean more towards the Democratic Party than WASPs do. By WASP, of course, we mean white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. By white ethnics, we mean whites that are of either Eastern or Central or Southern European ancestry. White ethnics tend to lean more towards the Democratic Party than WASPs. We also see religious diversity and cultural diversity among the Democrats. Really, we have to wonder what a lesbian attorney and a vegetarian university professor and a blue collar guy who union member who likes to go deer hunting, we really have to wonder what these people would have in common with each other. But all of these people would probably be likely to vote for the Democratic Party in many different contexts and situations. So if we see all this diversity within the Democratic Party, which is, you know, the party of the American left, what is the unifying thread? And I think it's obvious that the unifying thread is these are all groups that are in conflict with traditional WASP bourgeois American society. That is the traditional white Anglo-Saxon Protestant ruling class, as well as middle class, that was really the core, the ethnic majority, the cultural majority, the religious majority, the class majority, if we include the middle class in this, throughout most of the history of the United States. All of these other groups are groups that are in conflict with traditional WASP American society in some particular way. Whether it's on religious grounds, whether it's on cultural grounds, whether it's on ethnic and racial grounds. And we see that this opposition to WASP society is really the unifying force that holds all these different kinds of constituent groups for the left together. You know, whether it's the gay rights movement, whether it's the environmental movement, whether it's the feminist movement, whether it's labor unions, whether it's Muslim Americans or African Americans or whatever. So that's really what's going on, I think, when we take a look at American elections. I know Steve Saylor, who writes at VDare and some other places, talks a little bit about this. He argues that the Republican Party is implicitly the party of WASPs, of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, or at least of white people. I'm not sure how he'd figure the religious element into it. And of course, Steve Saylor is well known for advancing what he calls the Saylor strategy, where he basically says that if the Republicans want to be a winning party in the future, they're going to have to become an explicitly white party. That is, a party that advocates for the interest of whites through things like restricting immigration or opposing affirmative action, things of that nature. Now, I'm actually skeptical of Steve Saylor's strategy there. I think that demographic transformation in American society is such that it's already gone too far for that. But that's a separate discussion. But we do see that this is the common thread in American politics. We have this one party that is the party of the anti-WASPs and this other party that is at least implicitly in its rhetoric, maybe not in actual practice, but in its rhetoric and you know, symbolism and so forth is the party of the WASPs. Now, as for where this will go in the future, as for the implications of all this, as I said, I think things are becoming more and more polarized in a cultural and political sense. A couple weeks ago, I mentioned a work, and it's really an excellent analysis of electoral patterns in the United States. But there was a work published back in 2008 by Bill Bishop, who's a very mainstream writer, probably somewhat center left in his politics. He's a journalist based in Austin, Texas. But he was analyzing the way in which electoral patterns have developed over time since the mid-1960s. And what he shows in this is that those geographical regions, those states, localities, and precincts that vote, that tend to go Democratic, are going Democratic by a much wider margin than they once did. Those localities that are going Republican are also going Republican by a much wider margin. What that means is that in the red states, the Republicans are winning by an ever wider margin. In the blue states, Democrats are winning by an ever wider margin. There was an article in the American Conservative magazine recently by Dan McCarthy that also crunched some of these numbers as well and showed a similar result, that on the national level, demographic change and cultural change is such that the Republican Party, that the Democratic Party is becoming increasingly dominant. At the same time, Dan McCarthy showed that in some regions, the Republican Party is becoming even more popular, even though its popularity is receding at the national level. And all of this is consistent with Bishop's analysis of electoral patterns, that American society is becoming ever more polarized, and election results show that. And in a society that is becoming ever more polarized, what you do see is what I was talking about earlier, and that is people are starting to vote more and more along tribal lines. People are voting in the same way as others of their ethnic group or their cultural affiliations or their religious group, no matter what, no matter who the candidates are, no matter what the perceived state of the economy is, no matter what the perceived condition of the society is. And it's, the evidence is clear that that's the direction that our society is headed in politically. Now, as for some other implications of all this, one thing that's really interesting is to see try to take a look at where things will go in the future. There are certainly certain predictions we can make, I think. I think we can make certain predictions concerning what the future of U.S. politics will be. As the demographic change continues to take place, as the older people die out and the newer generations start to take their place, as cultural change continues to happen on a lot of different levels, I think that that's not going to be reversed anytime soon. I think that our own society will continue to move leftward for the reasons I've outlined for the foreseeable future. I don't think it will stay that way indefinitely, but for the foreseeable future, I think our own society will continue to move leftward. And what that means is that the Democratic Party will likely be the dominant party in national politics probably for the next few decades. Certainly if the lessons of any past partisan cycles are an example to draw on. Like I said, the Republicans were the dominant party from roughly the end of the Civil War up through the Great Depression. I think there were only something like two Democratic administrations during that time, and that was Grover Cleveland and Woodrow Wilson. Then, starting with the Great Depression and the election of Franklin Roosevelt, the Democrats were the dominant party on up through the late 1960s. The Republicans were fairly dominant up until fairly recently, and I think with the election of Barack Obama, we're seeing the pendulum swinging back in the other direction, where the Democrats are going to be the dominant national party probably for several decades to come. By extension, what that means is that the center-left will be the dominant political force in the decades ahead. And unfortunately, it also means that political correctness will continue to become ever more deeply entrenched in institutions. I've coined the term totalitarian humanism that I use to describe political correctness. And what I mean by that is, it's not a particularly sophisticated concept, but it's the idea that, you know, in the name of humanity, in the name of all the supposed ideals that the left promotes, like equality and universalism and social justice, we have to have a totalitarian society in order to uphold all of that. You know, whether it's soft totalitarianism, of the type that we see in the Western countries at present, or whether it's the hard totalitarianism of the type we seem increasingly moving towards. But unfortunately, what I call totalitarian humanism will likely become ever more deeply entrenched in institutions. Political correctness will continue to expand as the left, as, you know, by extension politically, the Democratic Party and so forth, continue to be dominant over the next few decades. Now, I also think that there's going to be increased polarization in our own society during that time. I think the center-left will be dominant politically, at least at the national level. But I also think we're going to start seeing more and more polarization. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that we're likely to see new waves of radicalism grow up in the decades ahead as well. You know, I talked about some of those movements that have appeared recently, like the Tea Parties and Occupy Wall Street and the Ron Paul movement. I think some of those are in many ways prototypes for the types of dissident political movements that we will continue to see develop in the decades ahead. I think in the future we're going to see an even more radically anti-state, anti-big banking, anti-military industrial complex movement of the type that the Ron Paul movement has sort of gotten the ball rolling for. I think we're going to see more movements comparable to the Tea Parties, which are the demographic of the Tea Party tended to be older, usually more middle to upper middle class white people. And I think that the Tea Parties were in some ways a prototype for movements representing that demographic that will evolve in the future. And then, of course, there's Occupy Wall Street, a movement from the left back in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was the anti-globalization movement, which was very similar to the Occupy Wall Street movement. Occupy Wall Street came along, 10, 12 years later, an even bigger movement representing the same kinds of ideas, the same kinds of constituent groups, the same kind of demographics. So I think that that's really the future of the left, or the radical left, not necessarily the establishment left, but the radical left, I think. So in the future, we're going to see more and more radical movements of this type. I think I've mentioned on this program before that the militia movement is actually larger now than it was during the 1990s, during its heyday, during the era of Timothy McVeigh and some of that kind of stuff. Also, I've noticed an increased interest in secessionist movements in recent years. When I started out in radicalism years ago, there was no interest anywhere in secessionist movements. And nowadays, I'm seeing new ones crop up all the time. Now, most of them are very small. Sometimes it's only a handful of individuals. But there is evidence that that kind of sentiment is growing. I saw a Zogby poll that was done a few years ago that showed that 1 in 6 Americans might be sympathetic to a secessionist movement in their own state or locality. So that's really a fairly significant number. You know, 1 in 6, we're talking about 18% or so of the U.S. population. So there's going to be a lot of political upheaval in the future. And I think that within the context of all this upheaval that's emerging, the center left is going to continue to be the dominant force at the national level. And I think it's going to this dominant center left is going to move towards the harder left with time. I think that as political correctness becomes more deeply entrenched, as what I call totalitarian humanism becomes more deeply entrenched, the hard left, the PC left, if you will, is going to be less inhibited about showing its fangs, if you will. I think a lot of the message that we hear from the PC crowd about how they're just trying to uphold the universal brotherhood of man and you know, fight for social justice and all these buzzwords and rhetorical concepts that they tend to hide behind, I think that will vanish. And I think more and more as the PC left becomes entrenched in institutions and becomes ever more powerful, it will have a lot less qualms about showing its true colors, about showing its fangs, so to speak. And I'll talk a little bit more about that after I return after the break. See you in a few.
What will it take for the bulk of people who leave Western universities to have the middle or common denominator view of the people in this room. It will take an earthquake, but it's not that difficult to achieve once you get people thinking in a dissentient way. This involves very much raising the game. I personally believe people agree with ideas long before they move towards them. They have an instinctual saying of yes. They say yes to the idea before they're completely worked out all of the formula for themselves. The countercurrents of this world exist to provide the formula for people after they've said yes, after they've put forward their first step upon the route to identity and the politics of identity. And the religion of identity.
Okay, welcome back to the third installment of this edition of Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, here at countercurrents.com. I've been talking a little bit about emerging political trends in American society, and I finished up the last segment by saying that I think that while the left will continue to become ever more powerful and ever more dominant in the future of American politics for the foreseeable future over the next few decades, it will start to show its fangs ever more. We will be facing more and more state repression and so forth. And at the same time, more and more opposition movements will emerge. And some of the movements that we've seen develop in recent times will be prototypes in many ways for the newer movements. And I want to talk a little bit more about that. I want to talk a little bit more about some other future developments that I see happening over the next few decades. I think that while the left will continue to be dominant, probably up through the middle part of the 21st century, which is roughly another 40 years or so, I think that what is causing that shift towards the left will also be the left's undoing in the long run. And what I mean by that is, as I said earlier, the left in its present form is really a hot coalition of a hodgepodge of different types of political interest groups that really have very little in common in terms of class, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of culture, in terms of political philosophy in some instances, in terms of race or ethnicity. There's really very little that all the different constituent groups for the left have in common, except for one thing, and that is their a common opposition to traditional American white Anglo-Saxon Protestant society and culture. I remember a few years ago, there was a video that was circulated in some alternative right circles of a fellow named Tim Wise. And Tim Wise is a left-wing activist who is very much a spokesman for political correctness, and he has a very strong anti-white, if you will, outlook. And he was he wrote this piece that was circulated, and he was saying, well, you know, white people may rejoice because they won a few elections here and there. I think some Republicans had just been voted into office in a midterm election. But really, you know, this is the beginning of the end because white Americans are going to lose their traditional majority status. And of course, Tim Wise was writing about this or talking about this in such a way that he was gloating over it and is talking about how isn't this wonderful that there's going to be this racial revolution against traditional WASP American hegemony. And I think in many ways, you know, whatever assessment we want to make of Tim Wise, I think in many ways his analysis of American politics in that sense was correct, in the sense that that's really what's going on in many ways. There's, you know, a type of revolution in progress against traditional WASP hegemony. But at the same time, I think that in the long run, that's going to be the beginning of the end for the left. And the reason I say that has to do with what I was saying earlier about how movements have to have some unifying thread to hold them together. Whether it's, you know, proletarianism, or whether it's anti-communism, or whether it's anti-WASPism, movements have to have some unifying thread. And right now, that's the unifying thread for the left, is opposition to WASP society. As WASPs tend to shrink in number through demographic change and become less powerful, that's bad news in the short term for WASPs. But in the long term, I think it will be the undoing of the left, because the left will no longer be able to hold WASP Americans out as a type of boogeyman around against which they can rally all of their constituent groups. I think that and in fact, you know, to some degree, now we see the beginnings of that. For you know, any time that the left wishes to attack its opposition, the first rhetorical weapon they throw out is to call their opponents racist and fascist and all these other things. And the left over time has tended to stretch the meaning of these terms so broadly that they really can mean just about anything. You know, I sometimes will joke with other people that, you know, terms like racist and fascist and sexist and homophobic, those terms are really becoming almost like curse words. You know, all the different swear words, all the different types of profanity, you know, the George Carlin seven dirty words that you can't say on television. You know, think about all the different contexts in which people use all those words in such a way that they really have no meaning. You know, think about how many different creative ways, you know, the F word is used. I mean, it's used in ways that have nothing to do with its actual connotations. And I think that some of these political swear words like racist and fascist and sexist and all that, I think those will go in the same direction over time, in that they just become all purposes epithets that really mean nothing at all. And as a result, they will lose their power. They will lose their bite as well. And when the left, when the PC left tries to throw out those kinds of labels against their opponents, the labels won't stick as well. They won't have as much force, because they will have been rendered meaningless. You know, it's kind of like the story of the little boy who cried wolf. He kept saying wolf, 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 you know, under false pretenses, and eventually no one took him seriously. And I think that's what the left is doing with some of these kinds of labels. So over time, I think we'll see the ongoing demographic and cultural change keep the left in power for a while, probably a few more decades. But what's going to happen eventually is that when the left is no longer able to rally its constituent groups around this boogeyman of the WASP enemy, what's going to happen then is that all of the different constituent groups for the left are going to turn on each other. They're going to cannibalize each other. Already, we're starting to see the embryonic stages of that, I think. Now, I think this is something that's going to have to develop over a fairly long period of time. I don't see it happening right away. In fact, when I was preparing this presentation this evening, I came across an article by Jonah Goldberg, who, of course, is a neoconservative, a columnist for, I think, National Review. You know, not somebody that we on the alternative right would have any use for, of course. But he has this piece that he wrote earlier this year where he's talking about how the left is starting to experience growing divisions between its constituent groups, for example, between unions in the private sector and in the public sector, between the traditional working class voters and proponents of mass immigration, between working class social conservatives and cultural leftists, and some of the things that are fairly predictable. Those fault lines are fairly predictable, and of course Goldberg is saying, well, maybe things don't look so bad for the Republicans because there's some fault lines in the Democratic coalition. And I think that Goldberg is wrong in the short term, but right in the long term, in the sense that while I do think the left will be dominant for quite some time, and that the center right, the Republicans, are in trouble, and of course the radical right, the true right, really has become a permanent opposition. There's really no the radical right really has no voice in mainstream politics at all. But I think the center left will be dominant for some time. I think American politics will shift further to the left, but in time, all these cracks in the PC coalition, all of these different constituent groups within the PC coalition, I think are going to start to turn on each other, and the left is going to self-cannibalize a little bit. I know from talking to activists from the left who have participated in things like Occupy Wall Street, that there's all of these divisions were showing up there, that you're starting to see more and more ethnic divisions among the racial minority groups. And I know that's particularly become an issue in regions of the United States where Hispanics have eclipsed African Americans as the largest minority group. In Southern California, for instance, they're starting to emerge a lot of ethnic conflict of that type between blacks and Hispanics. Of course, the conflict between Jewish Americans and Arab Americans is well known, and there are obvious reasons for that. Also, I think that as mass immigration becomes more prevalent, and many immigrants are bringing with them a lot of values that they retain from their own cultures of origin that are not exactly politically correct, I think that will put many immigrant communities in conflict with feminists, with the gay rights movement, and so forth. And I think all of this really is going to be the undoing of the left. Now, as to when it's going to come about, I think what will trigger the crack up of the PC coalition, if you will be when demographic change reaches a certain tipping point. Most demographers are predicting that by the middle part of the 20th century, roughly, that there will no longer be an ethnic majority, that there will only be a collection of minorities. I think that on one hand, that may be the left's dream in many ways, but it will be the undoing of the left in other ways, because the left will no longer have the WASP society, the WASP culture to hold up as a common enemy, and the left's different component parts will turn on each other. So I think in many ways we could say that demographic change is a type of victory for the left, but it's also the undoing of the left. Now, the big question, I think it's something that's interesting to speculate on, is what will come after that? After PC, what is going to happen in American politics? That's something that I've given a lot of thought to. While I do think that PC will become more extreme, it will become more deeply entrenched over time, it will become much more a status quo perspective over time, and that will last for a few more decades, I do think it's also quite interesting to speculate about what will come after that. And I think that when the PC coalition, if you will, cracks up, we'll see new coalitions emerge. And that could take on a lot of different forms. For instance, class is going to be socioeconomic class is going to be a major dividing line in the future of American society, simply because class divisions are becoming so much wider. And the middle class, the traditional American middle class, is declining, and there's no prospect of that changing. I don't really see any hope on the horizon, so to speak, that that's going to change anytime in the foreseeable future. I think the American middle class has seen its better days. So as far as class divisions, I think that's going to be very important to the future of American politics. Obviously, race and ethnicity are going to be very important, and I think we'll start to see Perhaps on one hand, the growth of movements among whites that emphasize identity to a much greater degree than what we have seen in the past. Although at the other side of that, as whites will be shrinking really as in proportion to the rest of the population, I think that may inspire a greater identitarian sense among many whites. A major fault line in the future also is going to be simply those who are for the system versus those who are against the system. More and more, I think it's going to be less a question of who's on the left and who's on the right, but who is perceiving the system as advancing their own interest and the interests of their own reference groups, and who sees the system as the enemy of their own interests and their own reference groups. I've spoken a little bit about fourth generation warfare on previous broadcasts, and I think that's a big issue. I think we're going to see an increased escalation of fourth generation warfare from all sorts of directions. And of course, on the opposite end of fourth generation warfare, you have the state itself. As William S. Lind, who's really one of the major theoreticians of fourth generation warfare, has written, really fourth generation forces are challenging states, that is, conventional nation states, in the same way that the rising socialist and democratic and labor movements of the early 20th century challenged the traditional monarchies and aristocracies. I know Lind had an article about that, outlining that analogy in the American Conservative a few months back as well. So that's going to be an important factor in the future of politics. Also, I think we're going to see a greater dichotomy between universalism and ethno-nationalism. On one hand, we have the universalism that the globalists, the liberal elites, if you will, the proponents of political correctness like to promote. And we see growing ethno-nationalism in different places around the world. And I think we'll see more of that in the West as well. I think we'll see increased ethno-nationalism among indigenous white European Americans and Europeans as well. And also, I think we'll see a growth of ethno-nationalism among non-whites. Another thing that a lot of commentators seem to ignore is the growth of what might be called generally postmodern cultural relativism. This is actually a major source of contention in many academic circles between those who are influenced by the liberal traditions of the Enlightenment and say that there's a such thing as human rights that are universal and binding on all cultures and so forth, and others who are more influenced by postmodernism and by extension cultural relativism, who say, well, no, wait a minute, aren't cultural values relative to the cultures of origins? That's actually been a debate in European society. For example, when it comes to criticisms of certain practices in Islamic communities, there are some people who think of themselves, for example, as left wing, as progressives, who nevertheless say, hey, you know, who are we to judge practices like clitoridectomy or other issues that more conventional liberals and leftists look at that are practiced in third world cultures and say, hey, that's awful. The postmodernists, the cultural relativists, are more likely to say, hey, maybe we shouldn't be judgmental about that. Maybe that's just a different way of doing things. And as the PC coalition eventually cracks up, I think that'll happen sometime in mid-century after it's been triggered by demographic change, we'll see new political coalitions emerge. It's possible that there could be some kind of national coalition that emerges that replaces the PC left eventually. I have no idea what it would be, but it would have to be a coalition of groups who have as their unifying thread opposition to the PC left, whatever other differences they have. Or there could be a multiplicity of regional coalitions that develop. even if there's no unified national oppositional coalition. And we could see that expressed in forms of regional political parties or secession movements. Of course, it's possible things could go to the extremes, and we could start to see armed conflict between contending political interest groups, between contending demographic groups as well. So the future of our own society and its politics is going to be very interesting, perhaps not particularly safe, but certainly interesting. And on that note, I thank you for listening to this broadcast. This is Keith Preston at Attack the System here on Countercurrents. Thanks to Countercurrents for hosting the program. Check out our website at attackthesystem.com if you like. Feel free to offer whatever support you would like, financial or otherwise. Help us keep doing these programs and the other things that we do. Have a good week.